This spring, we found out that the trash accumulation around Hawaii isn't a result of the 2011 tsunami in Japan. It's old-fashioned carelessness. Today, we'll talk with a Washington, D.C. group about its global efforts to clean up the trash. Meanwhile, outreach organizations working with homeless people are looking for landlords. A realtor group working with the Institute for Human Services is trying to help. We'll talk with IHS spokesman Kimo Carvalho in just a few minutes. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It's an opportunity to check in with the ever-lively world of French cinema at the Cinémathèque Française Film Festival 2016. And it's not on our official list of holidays, but Juneteenth is a long-standing African-American tradition dedicated to a memory that can never be forgotten.
That's the conversation. Now, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Kind of bringing focus to the homeless issue this morning.
Again, yes, and certainly you can talk about many parts to that, but we're going to talk about a very narrow part of it right now, but one that's been driving the conversation for a really long time. Now, for over a year, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has been driving the help for homeless people with two words, housing first. The fulfillment of the idea to get a permanent roof over a homeless person's head and then look to wraparound services depends on actually having a roof. Last year, Honolulu held a landlord summit to see what new units might be found. Other similar summits have since happened in Hawaii, but outreach organizations are still looking for landlords. One realtor group is now working with the Institute for Human Services to try to help. IHS spokesperson Kimo Carvalho is with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
In this last, not even quite a year, because it won't be here until November, that we've seen these landlord summits and trying to raise the awareness of what units might be available to house people who have been homeless. Has there been enough movement in your mind to think that maybe people are beginning to get the idea that we've got to look into our own inventory and in many cases also look in our own hearts?
A little bit. We've definitely seen progress like Locations Hawaii. You know, they've stepped up and they've, you know, since November have actually assisted us with offering five units to five of our clients, three of which were Housing First clients. And, you know, while they're actually jumping in on both feet and doing more like this week's clothing drive, you know, when we look at the bigger picture, it's not enough, Beth Ann. You know, this fiscal year, IHS is about to end this month. We've stabilized over 1,300 homeless people into permanent housing. And we're just one organization. You know, there's still Catholic Charities and U.S. Vets who also just won the Housing First contract. And, you know, between all of us, we need more inventory. And so this really is, while, you know, we did see a little bit of momentum because of the landlord summit, I think we still need more.
In looking for landlords and people who will step up, making the case for doing that seems to be where the progress, you know, where the process still is now. How do you make that case successfully when people hear sort of maybe one bad apple or actor story and then the mood falls?
I think the first understanding is to realize that there's, you know, bad apples everywhere. It's not just in the homeless community. And when you really want to look at the positives, that's really where, and the value, that's really where the sell is. And so having another resource there, like a nonprofit homeless organization, whether it be IHS, Catholic Charities, or U.S. Vets, be there to advocate for the landlord, be able to actually pay bills on time. If there's ever an issue, they can contact us and we will deal with the issues. If there's ever an eviction needing to be made, we can also replace that client with another client right away. And so there's actually a lot of value and benefits to working with homeless organizations like us. And I think once they start realizing those details and then you kind of tap a little bit into their compassion and emotions and they really feel, wow, I can be doing good while be doing good business. That really is a bottom line sell for them. And, you know, they start to listen and they want to work and they want to explore. test out a couple people, have some successes under your belt, and then you have a good, robust relationship.
But are they also telling other people who also might have units that same argument? I mean, because you're talking about it from both ends. Good business, getting paid on time, not a lot of hassles, and somebody else to take the heat and run interference. And feeling good about what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, they understand all these values, but it's not being shared at wide, you know, mass communication level. And I think that's really where the challenge is. And so what we really need to do, and part of my Kuleana, is to really outreach more to these landlords and property management companies. And so once again, the mayor and the governor put out there, we are pleading for the community's help to please consider renting more of your units. The ability to work with homeless providers to offer your units to former people that are homeless. And, you know, there's a lot of value to working with us. There's, other than the ones just mentioned, you know, it comes with furniture. It comes with, giving your taxpayer dollars a little bit more of a stretch by making sure that it's not being wasted on other high utilization costs like hospitals or prisons and what sort. It really does hit your pocketbook and your social bottom line quite well.
And just the practicality of it, that as the city is trying to build more units, look at the paper today, the Hassinger project, but as that's coming along, there's still the immediate need, and also communities needing to understand better what it means to house people who are homeless, families who have been homeless, veterans who have been homeless.
Yeah, we, right now we're moving a lot of people out of homelessness every year. And what we're using is the strategy that we're approaching this is by utilizing as much existing stock as possible. So whether it be mental health group homes, adult foster care homes, senior housing, or actually looking at affordable rentals, whether it's in a home or an apartment building, using existing inventory to house the people that need to be housed right away, which gives the city and state time to develop and build more. And so I think, you know, this is really, the best strategy we have right now, and we can really make it work, but we really need the public's commitment to offer these units to us.
When you talk about the good business of getting paid on time, that's a compelling argument. There's also the idea of, well, could this landlord be renting it at a higher rate, just at fair market value? And if that's the driver for good business, then that seems to thwart what you're asking.
A lot of the rates are based on federal HUD standards, and we discuss all that with the landlords, and we actually look at financial tables to say, okay, you know, there's these types of subsidies that last only 6 months. Some of these subsidies last 2 years. Here's what IHS is able to commit to the table. Maybe sometimes the client has to pay a little bit out of their pocket as well, but we do discuss the finances of the contract, and we actually help the clients understand, you know, their responsibilities and their tenant-landlord relations and expectations. And for the landlords, helping them to understand this is the reality of what we can offer. But it's not just about the payments. It's also about, you know, just not having to deal with the hassles of, you know, just bad tenants. We actually are putting our clients through life skills. We're making sure that they have good tenant-landlord behaviors. We're making sure that, you know, they are responsible and contributing to, you know, these homes that they're living in, because it is very expensive to, you know, maintain these homes, and they want just to have good tenants. And that really is, you know, when you're talking to landlords, that's the number one thing they ask for, is good tenants.
And making sure that when they come to the end of the subsidy, they are at a point where they can continue to be where they are, so there isn't that churn.
Self-sufficiency is huge, and that is something that, you know, IHS in particular strives to maintain, is, you know, maintaining the unit after the subsidy runs out. And, you know, I think that's also another reason why landlords like to work with us, is because it's that life skills courses. It's understanding, okay, you know, this subsidy is actually just to give me a hand up, to get me back on my feet, but it's also to buy me time to save money, to get employed, to really develop my life in a way that is sustainable long term. And that's what landlords appreciate.
As you're coming to the end of your fiscal year and you've pretty much maxed out everyone that you were hoping to be able to do by this point in time, now you're still looking at next year and more people falling into homelessness, as well as trying to maintain these people who are already trying to get out of it. What's your shortfall?
You know, we are, you know, if we're looking at about 1,300 people per year stabilized into permanent housing, you know, we're definitely going to have a shortfall within the next year or two of existing property management and landlord relationships. So we are making it a priority to really seek out these landlords and property management companies. You know, IHS stepped up this year by, you know, exhausting all the relationships we had because we took on a few contracts like the Housing First contract. And so we're really just looking for more right now.
But do you have a number in your mind of like, I need X number of units, and if you've got one, that's one less than...
To accommodate 1,300 people next fiscal year, that's probably the number that we really want to target. So, you know, what the shortfall is probably just shy of that, but 1,300 is what we need.
All right, 1,300 is what you need. We'll keep a running list of your progress.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming in. Kimo Carvalho is the spokesperson for the Institute for Human Services, Hawaii's oldest, largest, and most comprehensive human services agency focused exclusively on homelessness in Hawaii. He and other agencies are looking for landlords willing to rent to homeless people and families. Got a unit? Call IHS and let Kimo Carvalho know, or you can call us and we'll pass along your information.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Next time on The World, rescuing bees. A Bay Area man knows all about bee handling and beekeeping. He learned it growing up in Yemen.
You see how they dance, how they collect the honey, how they work. You feel deep inside there is a creator.
Now he's keeping up the family business thousands of miles from home. That plus the news on The World.
This morning at 11.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:15. Coming up, a rare opportunity to sample the best of today's French cinema. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawai.
When you think of ghost towns, you probably think of dusty tumbleweeds and deserts in the western United States. But Hawaii has its own share of ghost towns. One of them is the subject of today's backyard quiz. While their mainland counterparts were generally abandoned due to changing economic factors and natural resource depletion, Hawaii's ghost towns were usually the result of natural disasters. That was the case with this Hawaii island town, which was destroyed by a tsunami in May of 1960. The seaside town had been largely spared in the legendary 1946 Hilo tsunami, leaving its residents right in the impact zone during the 1960 event. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know the name of this town that was destroyed by a tsunami in 1960. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Eddie Kamai from the Sons of Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Even if you know nothing about French cinema, you've likely felt its influence. At least since the 1960s, American directors have looked to France for inspiration. it still has a lot to teach us. And don't be surprised if some of the movies in the Honolulu Museum of Art's Cinémathèque Française Film Festival turn up as American remakes in a year or so. The originals are always better, and Taylor Chang is the theater manager at the Doris Duke Theater. She's with us to tell us about them. Good morning, Taylor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Did you have to look at dozens of movies in order to make your picks for these?
Yeah, always. That's always the best part of the job, right? You get to see all these different types of films from all these different countries. I mean, of course, French cinema is one of the foundational it's the foundation of cinema. So we take the selection of our French cinema program pretty seriously.
Come to think of it, it is where it was invented, right?
Yeah.
The Lumiere brothers.
Yeah,
it's
the birth of cinema. Yeah, in the late 1800s.
You know, I was sort of part of the group of young cinephiles who watched all the Godard and Truffaut movies back in the day.
Awesome.
And ever since then, American movies have reflected that influence in a lot of ways, you know, from Bonnie and Clyde on.
Yeah, it's been interesting how American cinema has always sort of responded to or have been in competition with French cinema throughout its history. But you know, the spirit of American cinema is pretty different from the spirit of French cinema.
Yeah.
And it's hard to really kind of articulate the difference, but you certainly in French cinema, it's one of our themes for this year actually is to kind of use cinema as a platform for conversation and discussion. Uh-huh. So in our theater, for instance, we would, you know, create a space after the film for guests to talk about the film and to have intellectual, passionate conversations about the film, which could be challenging and could make you feel all different types of emotions. And that's something that French cinema has always been proud of inspiring. French cinema has never been afraid to sort of push the boundaries of aesthetics, mm-hmm. of form, of content, and their filmmakers who weren't just artists, they were also intellectuals, they were also inventors, they were, you know, Renaissance men in many ways. They thrived off of being in conversation with each other, and so the films themselves, they didn't just stand, you wouldn't just exhibit the film, you would also exhibit the film as well as have these spaces where you would collaborate and talk and have conversations with other artists, other poets, other, you know, inventors. And it was in that type of culture that the art of French cinema was able to thrive and continues to thrive.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily have that component in American cinema as much, you know, that kind of intellectual space to talk passionately about, you know, about the film. A lot of it is entertainment with the success of Hollywood, which has its own value and is incredibly important.
I can't imagine an American movie audience rioting when the Cinémathèque was shut down.
Yeah, exactly. there's a very specific type of culture around cinema in France, and it's something that, you know, of course, inspires our theater and inspires our museum.
Yeah.
And we're hoping to kind of bring back that kind of that sense of space.
Well, Taylor, when you talk about movies that provoke discussion,
what
comes to mind among the movies yet to be shown this month that might
do
that?
Francophonia, which is a film by Alexander Sokurov. He's a Russian director.
He did Russian Ark, which is an amazing movie.
Yes, and we're screening Francophonia this week. It's a film, it's a meditative visual poem about the Louvre, mm-hmm. about the museum, and about during World War II when the Louvre was hiding a lot of his artifacts so it wouldn't get destroyed during the occupation.
Yeah.
And it's basically a meditation on how the Louvre during that very specific period of time shaped the future of French culture, and you could argue European culture, based off of the decisions that they made during that time.
It's pretty amazing that the Louvre, and in fact the entire city of Paris, was not destroyed.
Right.
Even though it had been occupied by the Germans throughout the war.
And the film dives pretty deep into that. This film is an interesting one because Alexander Sokurov is a Russian filmmaker.
Yeah.
And the film is in both Russian, French, and German language.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of challenges what you expect from a French film. You know, you could argue that it's not a French film, but it's talking, it's very much about France and the culture and the art. And of course, we have, there's a nice little museum type, you know, being that we're the Hollywood Museum of Art, and it definitely resonates a lot of the questions that the film raises. It's like any museum has to sort of tackle those questions and when put into difficult situations.
Sure.
Yeah.
And his last movie about a museum, Russian Ark, was shot as if it were in one continuous.
It was
camera
and
shot.
And it was, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, it's beautiful. And you know, Alexander Sokurov is a filmmaker who's known for taking risks like that.
Yeah.
And Francophonie is definitely a risk film, I would say, in many levels. Because it is so challenging. It's not what you expect from a typical film, at the theater.
Well, that's why we go to film festivals, right?
You know? Right, to get exposed to all different tastes and,
kind of the things that maybe the multiplex wouldn't dare bring you. But
yeah, so, you know, we challenge people to check out this film.
Great.
You will definitely get something out of it.
Well, thanks a lot, Taylor.
Thank you.
Taylor Chang is the theater manager for the Doris Duke Theater at the Hollywood Museum of Art, whose 6th annual Cinémathèque Française Film Festival runs until June 26th, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
On n'a pas besoin de chercher si loin. Non, on n'a pas besoin de chercher si loin. On trouve ce qu'on veut à côté de chez soi. Des sourires, des aveux et des langues de bois qui t'alanguissent, te pourrissent et font de ton cerveau la jolie. Petit brouillon, oh, oh. Ou l'amour de son prochain.
Oi, tudo bem? This is Sandy Tsukiyama, host of Brazilian Experience. To celebrate Father's Day this week, I'll be bringing you 2 hours of musical fathers and their children, like the three generations of Jobims and the Caymmis. That's Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6 on Brazilian Experience.
Na expressão mais comovida das mais ardentes canções.
For a fourth year in a row, Hawaii Public Radio has a 4-star rating by the nation's largest charity evaluator. Charity Navigator's top mark gives you confidence that your donation will be used efficiently and responsibly. Many thanks to these members who have recently shown us their trust and support. David Tesler of Honolulu, Mary Queen of Hulualoa, and Jonathan Zarley of Kamuela. You can find a link to our Charity Navigator ranking at hawaiipublicradio.org, and we'll happily answer your questions about giving to HPR when you call us at 955-8821.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Three federal judges have now heard the oral arguments in a string of cases with one thing in common: deciding how much power Hawaii's counties actually have in regulating GMOs and their use of pesticides. And while it's unknown exactly when the judges will make their decision, what they say will have mainland consequences. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Watching some of this happen yesterday, and thanks to Civil Beat, by the way, for carrying this live.
You're welcome.
You're watching Point, Counterpoint, Point, Counterpoint. Let's talk a little bit about what led up to this and remind people about some of these cases.
Sure. So as we have talked about on this program a number of times, Kauai had an ordinance passed that would make seed companies like Monsanto and Syngenta abide by pesticide reporting requirements. Hawaii County prohibiting new GMO crops, genetically engineered crops, with the exception of rainbow papaya. That has an exemption. And then on Maui, there was a temporary ban to study the impact of GMO. All three of those were essentially made moot by the courts, but now it is before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so that is what the three judges were in town for yesterday, packed courtroom, lots of people on both sides following this issue very, very carefully, because it is really being described as historic, because as one person testified, there's at least 137 state and county laws elsewhere, not just the mainland, but also some of the territories that could be impacted, depending on which way the judges come down.
What we have heard for a very long time was that, you know, whatever the counties did was going to be preempted by state and federal law. That's been sort of the cornerstone of the arguments. But as you sat in the courtroom yesterday and heard what the judges were asking, what kind of nuanced discussion was being had that might mitigate what we know so far?
And I have to give credit to Anita Hofschneider. She was actually the reporter on the ground yesterday. I'd like to think that I was there, but I wasn't. But I can tell you some of the arguments that were summarized. Paul Achitoff, representing Earth Justice, he said the state law on agriculture is just not a comprehensive law. There's nothing to prevent a county from passing its own laws. Remember, these laws originating because of health and environmental concerns, pesticide use and so forth. And then on the other side was Marjorie Bronster, involved in that case with Monsanto and Maui. And she's saying, look, we have a highly centralized state government here. You just don't have counties break out on their own in trying to do these sorts of things. So these are the two arguments basically being presented here. Who has the right, the counties or the state and federal laws?
So you're talking about what's explicit and what may be implicit given the system as it exists now.
Right. I should just add that Gary Hooser, the Kauai councilman, he was comforted by what he heard yesterday. He says it's frustrating as a lawmaker, of course, there on Kauai, not able to have the authority to do something that he thinks is important to take care of the residents there. On the other side, Monsanto, Syngenta, others arguing, look, this is a very important business. We have a right to do this. So this is really going to be something else. We will be paying close attention to it.
You bet. Now, these three federal judges who were flown in from California for the purpose of hearing all of this yesterday, they're going to go away and they're going to render a decision sometime in the future. But do we have any sort of timeline at all on that? I know there's no specific date.
Right. Anita estimated that it could be a couple of months. And remember, whatever comes out, either in favor of the seed companies or county rule, if you will, it could also go up to the highest court in the land. Supreme Court would be the very next stop. And given the stakes here, I wouldn't be surprised if that is where this ends up.
I think that has great truth in that statement. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth. Yeah.
See you, Chad. Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair.
Good morning, it's 8:32 and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook. Here at Hawaii Public Radio, you can reach us in a number of different ways, one of them being our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Our Facebook page is Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, you can find us at HI Conversation, our BKOZHPR. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, the oldest African-American celebration of independence in our country.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephanie Dandler tells us about her debut novel, Sweet Bitter, about working in a high-end New York City restaurant.
The joints in your wrist just ache all night, and the heels of your feet, it's so physically punishing.
There's more: sex, drugs, staff rivalries, and the dreaded health inspector. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
You may remember that earlier this spring, a report by the Hawaii Coral Reef Initiative analyzed marine debris washed up around Hawaii, mostly on the north and east shores of the islands. What it found was that most of the trash wasn't a result of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan, but came from the carelessness of people in the Pacific Basin. The junk included fishing gear, plastic, wood, and household items. Since the report, we wondered what coordinated efforts might be underway to mitigate the trash buildup. We called Nick Malos, the director of Trash Free Seas, a program of Ocean Conservancy. He's on the line now from his office in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for making time for us, too. In looking at the shots of all of the junk that's been washed up around Hawaii, and that's only a fraction of what's moving around the Pacific Basin. We talk a lot about the Pacific Gyre, et cetera. What really is happening to stem the junk being tossed in the ocean in the first place, as well as to see what cleanup efforts might be happening?
It's a great question, and I think you hit the nail on the head in that Hawaii is really a microcosm of what's taking place on shorelines around the world. But given its location directly in the center of the North Pacific Gyre and the oscillating currents, Hawaii does see exorbitant amounts of debris, particularly plastics, washing ashore. And it's important to realize that, 8 million metric tons of plastic is now believed to be entering the ocean annually. And so we have a massive input of material coming into our waters and circulating the oceans every day. And for the past 30 years, Ocean Conservancy's International Coastal Cleanup has been bringing out volunteers on beaches around the world to pick up and prevent the various forms of trash and debris from reaching the water in the first place. But cleanups alone are not going to be the solution. We have to address this issue from all points of the plastic pollution vector. So thinking about how we minimize the amount of plastic waste and other forms of waste we're creating in the first place is very important. Thinking about how we better manage waste that's in the system, particularly in many places where waste management infrastructure does not yet exist. And then lastly, we need to continue to mitigate the threat of trash that's already in the system on beaches and waterways and ensure it never reaches the ocean in the first place.
That argument seems to be percolating around the U.S. How about other countries that are ringing the Pacific Rim that also are involved with this? Do they get it?
Yeah, so I think there is increasing awareness around the world, not just in the United States, but abroad. And we, Ocean Conservancy, have been working with many of the governments and organizations in Southeast Asia in particular, where we're seeing very large inputs currently going into the ocean because of rapidly rising populations, increasing consumption of plastics. And unfortunately, in these places, waste management has not been able to keep up. But this is not an issue that people are not aware of. Governments are actively working to figure out how you prevent these materials from entering the ocean. And we continue to work with these governments and organizations to find systemic solutions that don't just clean up plastic once they're in the ocean, but prevent plastics and other materials from ever reaching it in the first place.
Nick Malos, while these countries are trying to come up with ideas for preventing it from entering the system in the first place or entering the ocean, there's still all this junk that's floating out there. And we've been told by many scientists, by many researchers, that, look, we're really not going to be able to get out there and clean it up in the way that a lot of people would like. What's realistic, and is that really something that we should accept?
I think at where we are in this point in time, knowing that very large influxes of plastics continue to enter the ocean each year, where we need to focus efforts currently are stopping plastics from entering in the first place. And again, that's through minimizing the amount of waste that's being produced, better managing waste. But cleanups are an important piece. But I do agree and concur with the scientists that the cleanups at the moment should not focus on open ocean ecosystems, the gyres, the garbage patches, as they've been called, but rather focusing on both beaches and near shore environments. And the reason being is if we think about coastal ecosystems and river mouths where large deposits of trash enter the ocean, those are the densest points of where trash is entering the ocean. And if we overlay that with the notion that the majority of marine life actually lives in these coastal ecosystems, we then identify some hotspots in these coastal proximities where cleanups are most efficient, both from an extraction standpoint, but also from a resource and economic standpoint.
So which hotspots are at the top of your list?
Well, that's actively what we're looking at. And we do know, of course, domestically in the United States, there are some river mouths that deposit large inputs. But one of the reasons we are currently working with many of the organizations and governments in Southeast Asia is, as I mentioned, the science that shows where the relative inputs of plastics going to the ocean currently are largest identifies some of these major urban hubs in many of these rapidly developing economies as priority areas for focusing not only on cleanups, but intervention. And so we are currently analyzing where these places and the opportunities for intervention are largest.
Nick, you're a plastics expert. When we see plastic or think about it, very often we think about bigger pieces of plastic, you know, things that are household items or toys or broken off from, you know, fishing gear, all that kind of stuff. But what about microplastics?
Yeah, that you again are spot on. And we should remember that often a lot of the debris that enters the ocean is those large objects, the consumer items, the bottles, the bags, toothbrushes. And in the nearshore environments, those products do persist in their entirety. But very quickly over time, as those items begin to oscillate and circulate the ocean basins, whether it's from wind and wave action, radiation, those larger products do fragment into smaller and smaller pieces. And if we combine that with the notion of micro pellets or nurdles, the pre-production pellets that are used to make plastic products, there is a large amount of fragments and microplastics in the ocean. And the reason that is especially concerning is as plastics break down into smaller and smaller pieces, the number of animals living in the ocean that then can ingest those plastics increases. And so while we may think of the fishing nets and the very large items of plastic as problematic, and they certainly are, increasingly scientists are concerned about the ecological impact that these small pieces of plastics have on a broad range of marine organisms.
So what would you recommend that the rest of us do when it comes to not adding to all of that in terms of, you know, consumer products that we buy, or just, you know, we've heard people say just don't use plastic, but that obviously is not a practical thing. And there are microplastics in you know, cosmetic products and all kinds of things that we never really stop to think about.
Yeah, I think moderation is the key point. Certainly, I don't think it's realistic for us as a society to stop using plastics tomorrow. I think plastics provide a significant value to society in a range of benefits in medical applications and clean food and clean water. And particularly when we think about the broader systems and the impacts of greenhouse gas emissions, plastics are very resource efficient in terms of providing transportation and packaging. With that said, we all as individuals can reevaluate how we live our daily lives. And there are things like plastic bags, like microbeads and cosmetics that we simply no longer need, and there are viable alternatives for. And so individually, it may not seem like a significant contribution making these small choices, but these individual choices taken collectively as a global population yield very real impacts and benefits for a healthy ocean.
Nick Malos, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nick Malos is the director of Trash Free Seas. It's a program of Ocean Conservancy. He oversees the group's work on marine debris, including its global initiative on ocean plastics, the annual International Coastal Cleanup, and the Trash Free Seas Alliance. That last one is a cooperative group of businesses, leading environmental organizations, and scientists focusing on reducing plastic inputs to the ocean by 50% by 2025. We reached him at Ocean Conservancy's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Today in the backyard, we asked you about a Big Island town that was devastated by a tsunami in 1960. At one point in time, the town in question was the largest settlement in Hilo Bay. It was also home to East Hawaii's first church, founded in 1824. Although Hilo suffered heavy damage after the 1946 tsunami, this town sustained only minor damage. A series of tsunamis that came in the ensuing 10 years led to a blasé attitude toward the waves at a time when prediction and warning systems were still being developed. Residents never felt compelled to relocate to higher ground, as did many other Hilo residents. In the middle of the night on May 23, 1960, a tsunami originating off the coast of South America reached Hawaii, bringing 35-foot waves with it. A clock recovered from the devastation has been turned into a public memorial. Its hands remain frozen at the exact moment of destruction, 1:04 a.m. The town of Shinmachi, located in present-day Waiakea, suffered a direct hit and was never rebuilt. That's the answer to today's backyard quiz. And we didn't have a successful winner today, so I guess we'll just hang on to the T-shirt until tomorrow. Right now, it's 8:47, and if you have a quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Hi, good morning. I'm George Cleveland from Tamworth, New Hampshire. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
It has been 151 years since the last slave was freed in America. That's when word of the Emancipation Proclamation finally reached Galveston, Texas. The anniversary, known as Juneteenth, is marked in African American communities throughout the country, and as President Obama has said, Juneteenth has never been a celebration of victory or an acceptance of the way things are. Instead, it's a celebration of progress. It's an affirmation that despite the most painful parts of our history, things do get better. Sandra Shawhan is the vice president of the African Americans on Maui's Association, which will celebrate Juneteenth on Saturday, and she's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for the information that you gave as an introduction to Juneteenth. It was very relevant and also perfect in the information. Thank you.
Well, certainly, Sandra. And you know, there's always this question with history where, you know, every culture has got something extremely painful in its past. And in the case, certainly, of white culture in America, a great deal to be ashamed of. What is the value of keeping ugly memories alive?
The value of keeping ugly memories alive is, as you mentioned, Juneteenth is the oldest African-American celebration of the ending of slavery in America. And because it's celebrated on June 19th, then it becomes important, because my symbol for Juneteenth is chains, and Juneteenth symbolizes breaking of those chains. Even though we still have many challenges ahead of us, Juneteenth is very symbolic of the ending of slavery, though we still have many, many more challenges ahead of us.
Sandra, in your dealing with young people, young African Americans, do they understand the legacy of having ancestors who were brought here and lived in chains?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that, Chris, because I'm really not around young African Americans that much, even though I taught in the Department of Education for 39 years. What I do know is that unless the parents stress these holidays, these African American holidays that we share, and unless the parents bring their young children and their teenagers to these events that we have. The legacy will soon probably just be carried on by the elders among us, myself included.
But that's no good if it just remains with the elders, right?
Well, it's really hard to promote something because the elders will pass away, and soon things will be hard to keep going, but we still have to celebrate Juneteenth. For myself, I really enjoy the celebrations of Kwanzaa, the celebrations of Juneteenth, and our Martin Luther King Day, as
sure.
well as Black History Month. Those are very important events for me as a African American.
I would think that would be important for everyone of African American ancestry, just because of the need to understand what
yes.
went before. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Though attendance is sometimes small, the awareness still needs to be there in front of everyone, regardless of race, creed, or color, or sexual orientation, because lest we never forget these situations that happened in our history as we move forward and focus on the future.
Well, Sandra, as you say, you're an educator, and do you feel that the whole history of slavery was adequately addressed in formal education?
Oh, absolutely not, Chris. Absolutely
yeah.
not. It never was. You know, we was kind of promoted during the Martin Luther King's birthday in January. We would do something with that. And as an African American principal, I used at the schools that I was principal. I would try to bring these different events to the school, but I feel like that once I left the school, then that would probably be about the end of the emphasis, although teachers would try to carry those things on.
But why doesn't the school system itself, I mean, shouldn't it come from them?
It should come from them. It should be part of the curriculum. But Chris, right now there's so much emphasis on testing and assessment and meeting standards and budget concerns, and there's so many other pressures on the teachers and on the system that it's really difficult to squeeze everything in that needs to be done. And unfortunately, the cultural events that we promote don't get in there as much as I would like to see.
I'm hearing more and more about a movement in education to sort of protect students from disturbing information. And I find that whole movement pretty disturbing. I mean, if you're protected from disturbing information, chances are you're going to repeat whatever it was that disturbed you, right?
Well, and also there's a way to present this information that is not disturbing to children or not disturbing to others. It's just a fact of life. Unfortunately, I have to just say it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to be ignored, yeah?
One can't ignore it because it's still happening in many cultures and in many areas of the world. Right here in the United States of America, there's still people who are suffering from the bondage of slavery and the bondage of racism, and all of those things are still happening. Although they may be more subtle here in Hawaii, there's still a lot of racism, and there's still challenges that we need to face and move forward with.
Well, small steps, right, Sandra? At least
very small.
Yeah. Thanks so much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you, Chris, and I appreciate this interview.
That's a real pleasure. Sandra Shawn is vice president of the African Americans on Maui Association, which will celebrate Juneteenth at the African American Memorial in Wailuku's Iao Park from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday.
If you've been voting a while, you know this campaign season is like no other. What was divisive to begin with is now further complicated by the responses to the Orlando shooting. And while Hawaii won't make or break the presidential election, who does or doesn't support the presumptive nominees may show up in future state races. We'll talk with the Hawaii Democratic and GOP state party chairs later today at 5 on Town Square.
In the Atherton studio on June 18th, Ian O'Sullivan brings classical guitar stylings to his original compositions inspired by Oahu's majestic North Shore. Journey with him to the place he calls home by making your reservations today at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Beth Ann, we just heard a veteran educator say that she was not satisfied with the way the history of slavery was being taught in our schools.
Also heard her say something else that was very concerning, is that not really passing it along to younger members of the African-American community in Hawaii, on Maui, and wondering, you know, what's going to happen if that information isn't passed along. And not just the information, but the whole experience of talking about it and marking the occasion.
Yeah, I mean, we can never be unaware, should never be unaware of the experiences that made us who we are, right?
Exactly. We'll see if that begins to percolate a little bit better, despite all the pressures, both in school and outside of it.
Yeah.
As for us, it's almost 9 o'clock, so we have to say goodbye. But on tomorrow's agenda, we're going to talk with Hawaii Business Magazine's Steve Petranek about the Business Outlook and Sentiment Survey.
And Joe Moore will take a fresh look at Mozart's so-called rival.
Ooh, that's going to be a good one. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line whenever you like. It's always open at 808-792-8217. Email is available, too. That's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Facebook, well, find us at Hawaii Conversation. That's our page. Or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BecauseHPR.
Past shows are under The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.